WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Josiah Thompson is a detective who can quote Sam Spade and Kierkegaard. Before Thompson learned how to tail cars and track down missing children, he was a professor of philosophy at Haverford College. How the professor became a private eye is the subject of Thompson's new book, Gumshoe. He describes, among other things, how he learned to make surveillance an arcane meditation. Last year, he was named Best Detective of 1987 in the Bay Guardian in San Francisco, where he works. In 1976, Thompson was a tenured professor in his mid-30s, a former Guggenheim Fellow, and the author of three books, including a biography of Kierkegaard. He went on a one-year sabbatical that year from Haverford and moved with his family to San Francisco, where he planned to write a book about Nietzsche. The book was never written. Thompson got sidetracked. I asked him how he ended up working for a detective agency.
Well, not carefully, that's for sure. I went to California in the summer of 76 to write a critical biography of Nietzsche. The biography didn't get written. My marriage ran into troubles, and at a certain point, Hal Lipset offered me a job. Hal Lipset is a distinguished private investigator. And I started to work and took to the work like a duck to water.
What did you like about it?
What I liked about it was a number of things. I liked about the fact that the work wasn't in language. It was in the world. And for 12, 14, however many years, I've been working in language. I liked the fact that working as a detective, you knew if you won or lost really quickly. If you're tailing somebody and you lose them, you lost. If you stick to them, you won. Liked the fact that there was a kind of gritty hardness to it, that to do it right, you, if you're doing surveillance, you have to know where the payphones are, you had to know which way the streets ran. You had to be able to take care of yourself out there in the world, and that's what I liked about it.
What's the first job that you had that taught you some of these things and made you realize you liked the work?
Well, the first job was the first job I literally had. I went in for a job interview on a motorcycle and was told an hour later I was expected in Oakland to start tailing some people in a violent strike in near the docks of Oakland. I went to that location. Found my man, and of course, immediately made the first mistake. I pulled up beside him on a motorcycle and asked my way to Berkeley. The reason for doing that was that he had already seen my plate, and I couldn't stop in half block. He said, "Follow me," which was precisely what I had in mind doing. But of course, about a mile later on the freeway, he told me that he got off there and I should proceed along the freeway. And of course, so I lost him. I lost him that night. I lost him every time he turned around, it seemed to me, for the next 3 or 4 days.
You know, it does seem odd to me that a detective agency would put you on the job tailing somebody without any kind of preparatory work to tell you how to do it.
No, there was absolutely no preparation at all. I think in retrospect, although Hal Lipset, a friend of mine, will still not admit it, I think there was a little bit of stick it to the professor in all
this.
Oh,
right, right. Mm. Give him his comeuppance.
Yeah, right.
Who does he think he is?
I mean, Hal thought this is pretty funny. A full professor of philosophy who he can hire for $5 an hour to work as a detective. So obviously you'd like to haze him a bit.
Well, I figure one of the things you must have learned is all the stereotypes people have about professors of philosophy.
Yeah, you mean basically the ivory tower, the guy who can't find his way across the street.
And wouldn't know how to tie his own shoes.
Yeah, right, right. Well, I brought some of those features into detectivery, and I suppose that's why some of my friends always refer to me as Inspector Clouseau.
My guest is Josiah Thompson, who's a professor of philosophy turned private eye, and he's written a new book about his experiences called Gumshoe. Now, you had written about Kierkegaard. Which of his ideas, if any, did you find were applicable at all, or that you were thinking about in your new work as a detective?
Well, Kierkegaard is known as an existential philosopher, and his views basically compose themselves around the idea that you can't get there from here in terms of orthodox philosophy. You can't offer a picture, ultimately, of what reality is or the way the world is, that there's some fundamental ambiguity in experience. I'm reminded of Robert Penn Warren's line, the awful ambiguity of immediate experience. I think that reflects Kierkegaard's views in these things. And that's what I found again and again in the detective world, in the concrete world of work as a detective. The ambiguity of experience, the difficulty of clarifying things, the impossibility, really, of clarifying most things.
But before you were talking about how things are kind of clear-cut, you know when you win, you know when you lose. You get the information or you don't get the information.
Yeah, but then you move on to the next question. What really happened? Who really is telling the truth, right? And at that level, you really run into a wall of ambiguity, I think. And that's the brilliance, actually, of Hammett in all of these things. Hammett, who I still see as the kind of patron saint of modern detective writing. Hammett did it in a different way. The Maltese Falcon, for example, the classic, Hammett's classic work, you start with a fiction, with Bridget O'Shaughnessy's false story as to who she is and what she's doing. Now, by the end of the novel, at the very end of the novel, unlike the standard Conan Doyle English detective novel, which begins with fiction and ends with truth, the butler did it or he didn't, Hammett leaves you there in the midst of ambiguity. Again, you don't know what the real story of the Falcon is. You don't know what really happened here. Some people have died, others have been arrested, various things have happened. But you don't know what the truth is. And it seems to me that that's the brilliance of Hammett, and a brilliance that he brought to this craft because he was the only modern detective writer who ever worked as a detective. So he knew the lesson that I had to take a year or so to learn.
Well, you agree with him that chance and luck are more important than rational thinking when it comes to actually solving a case. What's an example of how rational thinking just wasn't working for you, but chance and luck paid off?
Well, rational thinking very, very, very seldom works. I can give an immediate example of how chance and luck didn't work. On my first job, I was tailing this guy in a bus. Now, if you've ever, probably none of your listeners have really tailed anybody on a bus. It's a rather unusual sort of thing to do. But look, think of the bus. I mean, there are no windows usually in the back of a bus. And if they are, they're hopelessly oily. So if you tail a bus, you can tail right up behind the bus. It's one of the easiest tails in the world. I didn't know that. On my first tail, I tailed this bus about a block behind heavy traffic in Berkeley. Since I didn't know the Bay Area, I looked down to a map. When I looked up, there were now two buses, two identical buses heading east on Shattuck. The result of this whole thing was that I lost the man. And that's what often happens in detective work. Chance and contingency are so important. For example, you can be sitting on somebody for 8 hours and never blink and do an absolutely brilliant job. And right when he moves, a bus pulls in and blocks your way out, and you lose him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I mean, constantly one's involved in the in that world of time and change and contingency. And the detective life, I think, has to do basically with how you get along in that world.
I want to quote something else that you quote from Hammett. I forget which novel this is. It's one of the Sam Spade novels.
Mm-hmm.
But the quote is, "My way of learning is to leave a monkey wrench." My way of learning is to heave a monkey wrench into the machinery.
Yeah, that actually is from The Maltese Falcon. And in another series of stories about the Continental Op, he says that his mode of operation is simply to stir things up.
And you do this?
Yeah.
How so? Give an example.
Oh, well, let me see. I'll have to find the... There is one case described in the first part of the book where I'm sent to New England. There's been a drug bust. Various things have happened, and there's $30,000 in a paper bag, and there's a can of drugs and some other things under a bush. I recover the can and now have to figure out how to get into the house to get the $30,000. Well, I stirred things up. I found first that the house was for sale, then found a realtor, went around to five or six different houses, and ultimately was successful in renting the house, which gave me access to it, and ultimately my wife Nancy came over from California, and we recovered the $30,000. Stirring things up there had to do, I mean, how do you handle a situation like this? The DEA is sitting in the house, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know there's $30,000 there. What do you do? Well, you don't walk up to the door and ask the DEA agent for the $30,000 that he forgot to find in the attic.
Right.
So you stir things up, you move around, get things in motion, and when you get things in motion, then other things happen, other opportunities open. And I think that's what Spade had in mind in offering that notion of throwing a monkey wrench into the works.
So what was your monkey wrench? What did you do to stir things up?
Well, simply by getting into the position now of renting a house, which was something certainly I never thought of doing when I went there. And then involving a realtor in going through various completely fake deals until finally this thing could be worked out. And then going through long involved conversations with the owners of the house, et cetera, et cetera. The problem was to get things in motion. And once you could get things in motion, then opportunities were available.
You know, one of the fictional detective characters I really like a lot is Lou Archer, because he's such a great interviewer. You know, he really knows how to ask questions to people to get information from them. Did you find that something you had to learn, how to get information from people?
Yeah, well, I don't think there's any simple way. You ought to know this of all people, Terry, because you interview such a marvelous range of people each week. I don't think there's any simple way of doing that. I think you have to really listen to what somebody's saying, and then attend to, of course, body language, tone of voice, all those things. But I think it's very individual. I don't think there's any theory of how to interview somebody. Do you?
No, I really don't. And I think it's a very personal thing, too. But you really can't betray yourself when you're a detective sometimes. You know, you have to get information without people even knowing why you want it.
Yeah, but most often, it's really straightforward. Most often, I find that the straighter you are, the more successful you are.
You mean the more straightforward or the more
straight-looking? Yeah, right. No, Fetchheimer, my mentor, once explained this in terms of a parable from his history as a detective. He said he had this case where he had to get into the front room of this ground floor apartment, and he agonized over how to do it and how to do it and how to do it. Finally decided, he took an operative out with him and put the operative in front of the window and threw a baseball over his head through the window into the room. Then they went up very apologetically and got entrance to the room, did or saw whatever they needed, and left. In other words, oftentimes the most effective technique is a direct one. In that case, throwing a baseball through the window.
When you started detective work, did you have to learn how to look and act tough, tougher than you might have actually felt?
Are you kidding, Terry? I'm 5'8", 150 pounds, and I'm 53 years old. Look, I can't look tough. There is no way on this planet I can look tough. Winning through intimidation is not part of my repertoire.
Well, so what techniques have you found instead to look like someone who can take care of themselves? Don't you have to do that? Look like you can take care of yourself so that nobody else intimidates you or takes advantage of you?
Well, I think it's often more useful not to look like a detective. Not to look like any of the cliché.
I mean, when you're getting information from people, that's more
effective. Yeah, when I'm getting information from people. I take it that you're thinking of situations where you might be in bad areas or in unusual situations close to criminals or things like that.
I don't know. In all the detective novels I read, there's always some kind of double deal involved, or the case becomes... The case goes much deeper than the detective ever thought, and there's terrible things waiting right around the corner, and, you know, there's some kind of violence usually waiting, even though you wouldn't have expected it from the case at the beginning.
Well, look, violence is something that the real detective hardly ever experiences and certainly wants to stay far away from.
Mm-hmm.
I don't carry a gun, I never have, and I never will.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't for two different sets of reasons. One, prudential, that I'd probably shoot myself in the foot, or somebody would steal it and shoot me, not in the foot, but somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, that to carry the gun really means that you've dropped to the level of coercion.
Mm-hmm.
And, I have a lot to do with areas of human life, with, as were the border between the legal and the illegal. And I don't want to
sink to the subhuman and live in there. That's what the challenge is to try to maintain one's humanity in an area that's very hazardous for that. So I use my head, not a gun. If any detective ever used his gun, especially like these chaps on TV, they would have made lots of mistakes before they ever had to use their gun.
Mm-hmm.
So violence is something to stay away from. Use your head to stay away from.
Yeah, interesting points. Well, we're going to take a short break here, and then we'll be back. My guest is Josiah Thompson, who is a former professor of philosophy at Haverford College, but for the past few years he's been a private eye. He now is a partner in his own firm. He's written a book about his experiences as a detective. It's titled Gumshoe. More in just a couple of seconds. This is Fresh Air. Detective Josiah Thompson is my guest, author of Gumshoe. Well, you've had your own private practice for the past few years after working with other detective agencies. What do you specialize in now that you can call the shots more?
Well, still criminal defense. Let me give you a snapshot.
Yeah.
3 weeks ago, I'm in New York right now. Three weeks ago, I was here in this area. And I was working on three different sorts of cases. One was a death penalty case for the Public Defender's Office involving scientific consultations with forensic pathologists in Pittsburgh and Atlanta. I took various pieces of tissue around, and we looked at it under the microscope, and I got their opinions and elicited their help in terms of testimony later on. That was one. The next case involved a case for Kunstler's office, the Japanese terrorist who was arrested, or the alleged terrorist who was arrested on the Jersey Turnpike with three bombs in his car. Did a little work in New Jersey on that, and then moved up to Toronto, where I have a drug case involving the arrest of six Canadians in Los Angeles for exporting allegedly conspiring to export about a ton of non-existent hash. I thought they should get a medal from Nancy Reagan for exporting drugs out of the country, but apparently the DEA didn't see it that way. So those three cases, I mean, that gives a kind of snapshot view of what I'm doing now.
Let me ask you briefly about the terrorist case. Now, I know you're not at liberty to talk about the details of the case because mm-hmm. it's still in the courts, but this is an alleged Japanese terrorist who was found on the New Jersey Turnpike with, arms and bombs in the car?
No, there weren't any arms. I mean, I'm just speaking in terms of the press reports. The press reports report that the authorities found, I think, two or three bombs made in the form of fire extinguishers, filled with black powder and shotgun pellets.
So your job was to try to find information showing that the search was illegal.
Well, my job, I'm not at liberty to certainly broadcast on radio what I was doing.
Right.
My job was to perform some investigations for the defense, as I've done in many, many other cases, and pursue whatever issues the defense had in this case.
Did you have any second thoughts about taking on a case like this, given that it's an alleged terrorist who is the client?
Oh, there's no way that any of us can choose between our clients. We don't have to like our clients. We
mm-hmm.
don't have to need any of that. Look, basically, my job is simply to go out there and get the information that the attorney or the client wants. And I can't ask those sorts of questions as to whether the person I'm working for is a nice person or an unnice person. I've probably worked for some of the most unnice persons on the planet at some point or another. But unnice persons deserve a defense just as much as nice persons. And my job is just to go out and do the job, not try to resolve that question as who ought to get a defense and et cetera.
You worked for the defense of William and Emily Harris in the Patty Hearst kidnapping to prove that Hearst wasn't brainwashed?
Oh, that was an investigation a long, long time ago.
Can you tell me real briefly, like, what you did on that?
I don't think I can.
Okay, fine.
I don't think I can.
Ask me all this privileged information?
Well, here's what happened.
Yeah.
A deal was made. The case never went to trial.
Uh-huh.
And I do have very, very strict intense strictures on what I can talk about. That's very relevant to this book because, see, I don't have a release from my clients in that case. In the book, in Gumshoe, I have releases from all these people. For example, Henry Bauer, the detective who assisted me in tying this guy up and holding him for 22 hours in Bombay as we took his child and took the child out of the country. I have a release from Henry. I have a release from the mother and child. Things of that sort. So in the book, I can talk about these things legally only because I've been straight with people and they've given me their permission to talk about them. You're asking me about other cases where I just don't have that permission.
No, I understand. I didn't realize that's the way it worked, but now that you've explained it, I really understand. Something that you do write in the book that really made me think, you were in the process of working with a locksmith to get into a car for a case you were working on, and the police stopped you, handcuffed you, and thought that you were two real dangerous guys until they realized who you really were. And it made you think that if you were killed on the job, it wasn't going to happen when you were doing something glamorous or especially important, but when you least expected it. Does that kind of thought still haunt you a lot?
Yeah. If you speak of TV detectives never seem to be worrying either about what they're doing in terms of the right or wrongness of it, or worrying about whether they're going to get killed or not. I do a lot of worrying in this book about things like that. And I think one edge to the whole experience of the detective is what might be spoken of as a kind of paranoid edge. The point about it is that if you're dealing with the world, if you're out there in the world, if you have some sort of thirst for the otherness, for the raw bone of the actual, something that I have, then part of that raw bone is the fact that it can become very dangerous. And that the world is not within your control. So there's this level of always looking out of the corner of your eye and vaguely being aware that when something awful happens, it's going to arrive on you very quickly and thunderously, probably from behind. I kept thinking of John Kennedy in this regard. I wrote this other book on the Kennedy assassination. Mm-hmm. As Kennedy was driving along Houston Street, Nellie Connolly turned to him and said, "Well, Mr. President, you can't say that the people of Dallas don't love you." The car made its turn under the depository. Kennedy smiled and said, "Yes," and within seconds the shots crashed into the limousine. That may be a kind of metaphor for at least how I view sudden death.
Yeah. Well, so how do you keep this maybe low-level, constant awareness and fear from getting out of hand and becoming disabling terror?
By self-deception and humor. <I think. laughs> For example, my partner, we've told this story many times, but my partner visited a witness, and the next person who visited the witness later on in the day got blown away. And my partner has always expressed that he has a fine sense of timing about interviews.
Oh, God. during one of your cases, you were following a woman for an adultery case. She found you following her and didn't know what you were doing, thought maybe you were a peeping Tom or maybe a detective. So she asked you for some ID. You showed her a card from your former profession, your professor of philosophy card from Haverford College. And she believed you, and of course you knew the part and how to play it. Do you think Haverford knows that you still have those cards and are using them as a cover?
Well, this was my ID card from Haverford. That was used in the very first months where it was valid at the time. I had not officially resigned. I was still a professor of philosophy. Now, one of the interesting things about that card concerns the writing of the book. You see, the point about Gumshoe is that they're real names and real places, real events.
Uh-huh.
It's all nonfiction, the real thing. I remembered this incident, but did not recall the whole incident with the woman, and finally got out the card and looked and noticed that there was no expiration date on the card. And that reminded me of our little conversation in which she called attention to the lack of an expiration date, and I pointed out that in small Quaker colleges on the main line, they figure that their tenured faculty will not expire very quickly. And that then became part of the conversation. So it's the ability to, I had in these files, I had photographs, I had documents, I had notes, and I had the actual ID card in this case.
the possibility of referring back to those sorts of artifacts for more and more information, I found to be fascinating, because it was like an archaeology about rediscovering the past all over again in the very writing of the book.
Well, do you think Haverford College is going to reprimand you?
No, I was there yesterday.
Oh, okay. Let me tell you, I interviewed a detective within the past couple of years, you know, a real-life detective, mm-hmm. who had done a lot of interviews in his time. Mm-hmm. And after the interview was over, and after he kept me totally entertained with all these stories of his cases and stuff, mm-hmm. I said, so, are you still working on a case now? And he explained to me that actually, in his office, he had a lot of people who he delegated all the cases to, and he basically went around doing interviews. And I'm just wondering, now that you have a book out and you're becoming kind of well-known yourself, would you want to get into that kind of situation, or would you want to prevent that from happening?
Oh, no, look, I've got live cases going on right now.
Right.
I mean, I want to be back in San Francisco in 2 days, because things are really going on in these cases. No, look, earlier I was part of a larger operation. The way to make money in the detective business is you hire a lot of people, you don't pay them very much, and you charge a lot for their time.
Right, basically. Right.
Yeah, Marx is right. Exploitation of labor is the way you make money. Right. I don't want to do that. I ended up, when I did that before, as a talking to lawyers and accountants. I didn't quit the academic world to become some sort of small businessman. I quit it to be a detective. I love it. And I'll be going back to it in about 2.5 days. I better get back there in 2.5 days. No.
Okay, well, thanks so much for talking with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been Josiah Thompson. He's a professor of philosophy turned detective. He's written a new book about his life as a detective. It's called Gumshoe, Reflections in a Private Eye. He works in San Francisco, and his new book is published by Little Brown. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.